It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here. We've got a lot of security news. A surprising update on the Marcus Hutchins Legal Defense Fund. Steve's going to explain some of the latest news about the Intel Management Engine. It turns out, thanks to the NSA, we now know how to disable it. And he'll explain how Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, applies to your security policy. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 626, recorded Tuesday, August 29th, 2017. Shattering Trust. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online with this, well, normally it would be with Steve Gibson, but I don't, somebody else is sitting in for Steve. No, it is Steve. And for those of you listening, you'll sound just like Steve. But there is
it has not changed my voice at all.
There is something a little different. We're going to call you Babyface from now on.
that actually has been the consistent response from various women who have seen me since. Is, wow, you look younger. It's like, well,
Steve shaved his. How long have you had that mustache?
Forever. It was briefly removed while I was married. Juliet wanted to see what was under there. And
then she said, put it back. Put it back. I don't know who this is.
You know, she just wanted to change everything. So,
yeah.
You know, to sort of make it hers. Anyway, so it came back. And but I don't know. So I've been thinking about it for a few months. And finally I said, well, if I don't like it, I can always let it grow back. But, yeah, I think the reaction has generally been favorable. So, what the hell? Time for a change. Now, the problem is weird, too, because, you know, I didn't realize that in this new world we live in, my picture is everywhere.
Well, we have to redo the mugs.
Twitter feed. Right. My Twitter feed and, you know, you and me as Jean-Luc and Picard and number one. I can't think of his name.
The guy with the beard. Frakes. Jonathan Frakes. What we're going to have to do here, actually, I think it makes the mugs more valuable. This is the
collector edition.
Collector's edition with Steve with his mustache.
For 12 years of the podcast.
Yeah.
Never to be revisited. Get them before they sell out because, you know, who's going to make more of those
Twit, we will. Twit.tv. Twit.tv/store. They have Security Now mugs with. And the best thing about this, and I think this was Nitro Zach who did your original illustration, a little editorializing on her part. You look quite confident and cocky in these, and I love it.
I look snappy. I've never liked that picture. I look aloof and like, you know what doesn't stink. I was like,
you look like I'm secure and I'm proud of it or something. I don't know. I like it. To me, that I know it's not your personality, but I do like those. And we have T-shirts and mugs, and they're available at twit.tv/store. When you see like last day to order and all that, that's just the way that our supplier Teespring works. We will always make more. It's just a little weird thing about we sold 74 of those mugs, by the way, Steve. I think that's a store record.
People are tweeting me themselves sipping coffee from them, so thank you.
And I don't think we're making money. If we are, it's just a couple of bucks on these. They're $15 for the mugs, and I think $18 for the T-shirt, and it's $23
for the T-shirt.
Less than Starbucks, and we have a variety. I think we even have, we have a hoodie. Now that, if you're going to DEF CON or Black Hat, you should wear a Security Now hoodie, for sure. That's $38.99.
That'll keep you warm.
So what's coming up today on the show?
Okay, so today's podcast, number 626, I titled Shattering Trust after the title of the coverage we're going to give at the end of the podcast of a research paper titled Shattering Trust, which is really interesting. But, of course, as always, we've got a bunch of stuff to talk about. We're going to cover a little bit of the ongoing drama surrounding Marcus Hutchins. Another little wrinkle has surfaced.
Yeah.
Examine a reported instance of interagency hacking, which I wouldn't have expected. But after you hear about it, it's like, oh, well, sad, but probable. We're also following the evolving market for zero-day exploits. Examine trouble arising from the continued use of a deprecated, actually a long deprecated, 4 years now, Apple Security API. Discover that Intel's controversial platform management engine that we've talked here about here often can, after all, be disabled. Look into another instance of SMS attack, multi-factor attack. Bring note to a nice-looking time-based one-time password authenticator. Recommend an alternative to the shutting down crash plan, which a lot of our listeners apparently subscribe to, and said, oh my God, where do I go?
Carbonite, of course, our sponsor.
Carbonite even recommended, they recommended Carbonite as an all-in-one alternative. We're going to deal with a bit of errata, and this one really caught me off guard. And when I saw the first mention of it, I thought, oh, I probably misspoke once. And then it turns out, no, apparently I just used the wrong word through my entire litany.
And so, I didn't catch it. I apologize.
Well, I didn't catch it. And so I must have used it initially wrong, and then I just kept on using it wrong. So we're going to fix that. We're going to take a look at this interesting bit of research, which, of all things, invokes the wrath of Khan.
Ooh.
I think a good podcast for us.
The Wrath of Khan. And by the way, I've just been handed this note. Alex Gumpel says we're working, our R&D division is working on new Steve Gibson Security Now t-shirts with removable Velcro mustaches. So you get
perfect.
You get on or off. So we're going to get that out of R&D and we'll let you know.
Or have some of that white out. the mugs are white, you can just cover right over them.
Steve, yay. Mustacheless Steve Gibson. Take me a while to get used to this, I'll tell you.
Oh, I don't spend much time looking at myself.
Right, you don't know.
This happened around the middle of the day on Saturday. And
what was it like shaving it?
It was weird. And I, did it again this morning for the podcast. And I have to be careful because, although it's better.
Your lip is tender there.
You have to kind of get in underneath and get the upper lip and push that. Yeah. So anyway, it's.
But your coffee tastes different, I bet.
Okay. So our picture of the week reminds us of that classic dumb joke from the old days when we were in, elementary school. Is your fridge running? And, you would call someone. Exactly.
You say, do you have Prince Albert in a can? And they'd say, yes, we do. You call a tobacco shop. See, that's how old-fashioned this is.
Yeah.
Yes, we do. Well, let him out. Or you call a housewife. Is your refrigerator running? Yes. Well, you better go get it. It's getting away.
Right.
Ha, ha, ha.
So updated to this world of 2017 is our picture of the week that poses the question, is your fridge running? And then and then when they say, whatever, it's because I can't log into it anymore. So, yeah, our brave new world.
Yeah. Did you watch Silicon Valley on HBO?
Oh, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Yes.
That was one of the big plot points this season was hacking into, because I can't remember their names. The kid who was in the incubator bought a very, very, very fancy computerized refrigerator.
Oh, right.
Remember? And then
the younger Asian guy
Jay Lin or whatever is, and then of course it drove Guilfoyle crazy, and so he spent many hours and ended up using all the CPU cycles in their server to crack this refrigerator, and then it just said. And nasty things. It was great. I love that show. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Well, I think what's fun is for techie geeks like us, it does tie into all of the experiences that we're having and sharing.
Biotin.
So, I mean, it's very relevant.
Yep.
So, okay. In our Marcus Hutchins news is a sad story with, I think, an interesting takeaway. Kevin Collier, who is BuzzFeed's news cybersecurity correspondent, reported some unfortunate news surrounding the high-profile arrest that we've been covering for the last couple of weeks, post-DEFCON, of the so-called WannaCry hero, Marcus Hutchins. It turns out that the overwhelming majority of money, which had been raised to pay for his legal defense, turned out to have been donated with stolen or fake credit card numbers.
Oh, man.
And as a consequence, all donations, including the legitimate ones, because there was no way to tell them apart, are being returned, according to Tor Eklund, who's the attorney who was managing the fund. He reported, I think it was last week, that at least $150,000 of the money collected came from fraudulent sources, and that the prevalence of the fraudulent donations effectively voided the entire fundraiser. He said he'd been able to identify only about $4,900 in legitimate donations.
Now, who would do that?
I know, but he couldn't be certain even of those. He told reporters, quote, "I don't want to take the risk, so I just refunded everything." One person had five different charges to his one credit card, Eklund told BuzzFeed News. Odd number values, the kind you'll glance over when looking at your bill. Designed, obviously, to hide them and obscure them. And so, clearly, what happened is people began getting their credit card statements and said, wait a minute, what's this charge? I mean, it happens to us all the time. It's mostly all Sue does for me is someone will call up and say, what? I didn't ask for any research. And Sue says, did you buy SpinRite? Well, of course. Well, that's where you got it. Oh, and then they are happy and they go away.
Oh, I get it. Gibson Research. I get it. I didn't buy research.
nobody thinks of us as, you know, the SpinRite people. So basically, Sue sits around explaining to people what that charge is on their credit card statement, and they're happy. Anyway, in this case, Eklund started getting, who was in charge of this, started getting all of these calls from people saying, who are you and why did you charge me X amount of money? And he said, did you donate to the Marcus Hutchins Legal Defense Fund? And they said, who's Marcus Hutchins? No. And so anyway, big problem. He said he's still determining what to do with a Bitcoin wallet, which was set up to take donations for Hutchins, which has received 96 small donations worth a total of about $3,400. So, you know, the problem, of course, is that there's no doubt some legitimate, well-meaning, good-hearted people among the noise, and the noise, however, swamped it all and ended up, I mean, I don't know if the bad guys intended this to happen in order to kill the fund or thought they were doing Marcus a favor. But, of course, if that was the case, it ended up completely backfiring.
Yeah.
And as we know, his arrest shocked the community of cybersecurity researchers who have since largely rallied behind him and tried to raise money for experienced attorneys. At the time, Eklund stepped in to host the fundraiser after GoFundMe refused to host it, citing concerns with its terms of service. So I don't know what that was about, but okay. So, of course, as we know, Hutchins, who pleaded not guilty to all six charges against him on August 14th, has retained Brian Klein, an L.A., that is Los Angeles-based trial lawyer, and Marsha Hoffman, an acclaimed expert on U.S. hacking laws, both as his attorneys. And as we discussed, I think it was last week, a judge told him he could not return to the UK before his trial, yet he had free roaming through the U.S. I'm sure they pulled his passport, and they also GPS'd him. And his trial is set for a little more than a month from now in October. And in the meantime, he's hanging out in Venice Beach and enjoying the weather and, and waiting for trial. A woman named Tara Wheeler, who is a friend of his, previously had told BuzzFeed News that she planned to set up a new legal defense fund for him, but did not immediately respond to their follow-up request for comments on this story. Eklund said he believes he has refunded every donation to the fund, but that anyone who hasn't heard from him can email info@TorEkeland, TorEkeland.com for their refund. And, of course, right on cue, and apropos of this, we have the just-posted note from Brian Krebs, who posted a piece with the headline, "Beware of Hurricane Harvey Relief Scams."
Oh, no.
What's wrong
with people?
Brian writes, U.S. federal agencies are warning citizens anxious to donate money for those victimized by Hurricane Harvey to be especially wary of scam artists. In years past, we've seen, writes Brian, shameless fraudsters stand up fake charities and other bogus relief efforts in a bid to capitalize on public concern over an ongoing disaster. And our listeners may recall that when I mentioned this Hutchins Legal Defense Fund, I was inherently cautious about it.
Yes.
You know, I looked at the site. I scrutinized it as best I could for like any signs of legitimacy and illegitimacy. And I even said, you know, I can't vouch for this, but I did look at it and it appears legitimate. Now, I don't know what that even means because, you know, I guess it would be obvious if it didn't appear legitimate, if it was broken English or, you know, like any of the cues we're used to seeing in, you know, poorly produced spoofs. But, you know, as they say, there's no way to, what is it, disprove a negative? I don't know what that is. But
yeah, that's exactly right. You can't prove a negative.
Yeah. So yeah. It's like, okay, it's there, and it seems like the right one. And it was, as it turns out, but that didn't save it. So, it occurs to me that we're seeing something of an emerging trend with this, which is high-profile online things of any kind that attract outsized attention of any sort are not left alone and allowed to function as intended. By being high profile, they become targets of mischief. And if those sites are not adequately prepared to actively fend off mischievous or malicious attacks, disaster results. And of course, we had another example. When the FCC put up the net neutrality feedback site, it was so swamped with fraudulent postings and other nonsense as to become virtually useless. They had to pull it down, take it offline, then they tried to put it back up. But, of course, it had been ruined by a ton of insincere crap that had also been put up. So, you know, and now here we have an entirely well-meaning online fundraiser similarly rendered useless by fraudsters who stole money from others' credit cards to illegally contribute to Marcus's defense fund, of course, ultimately not helping him at all, and as a result, collapsed the entire thing. So, you know, I don't know how you could protect against this. Maybe question multiple donations from the same credit card. That you could certainly check, but they weren't doing that. Because if nothing else, it would have raised an alarm immediately to put this thing on hold when a duplicate charge from the same person. And then, you know, follow up, verify with the person, and so forth. But that wasn't there. So, for example, perhaps in both cases, this was sloppy and immature website design to put up a minimally functional web surface that wasn't sufficiently proactive against malicious abuse. We've seen and covered many examples of such short-sighted design in the past on this podcast. And this is sort of the logical extension of the how do websites store our passwords question. As we know, there are ridiculously wrong ways and very strong ways to solve exactly the same problem. And the approach taken doesn't really matter if everything always goes well and the strategy never is put under stress to test its strength. Because when weakly designed and or implemented systems are put under stress, then they will collapse and fail. So I think that helps us to sort of put this into context. That is, there are lots of sites with bad security, but because no one really cares about them, it's like, well, okay, it works, and it's not until, though, something happens that draws a lot of attention, and then, boy, you know, disaster strikes quickly. You know, and we're operating when you think about it, in a completely unregulated environment where there are no controls. Anyone can do anything they wish. Set up any kind of website they choose using whatever technology occurs to them first. I had a more colorful metaphor there initially. I thought, no, that's inappropriate. I doubt that imposing regulations upon the industry will help. But I think we do need to make use of more well-thought-out solutions easier to deploy. Things like we were talking about last week, the Libsodium cryptographic library, which was recently audited and which has bindings to virtually every language. So there's no excuse for not deploying strong crypto, and it brings useful drop-in encryption to a much larger audience. The next step then would be to incorporate similar libraries into drop-in problem-solving packages provide all the rest of the plumbing so that much of the underlying work can become standardized around solid solutions. And in such a future, accepting and storing passwords don't need to be written ad hoc, because the right way to do it would be built in to every platform that a developer might choose to use. So essentially, you know, those things become commodities as they absolutely should be, so that it's just done for a developer rather than it being up to them to just do something which is as likely to be incorrect as not, because not everybody is experienced in secure design concepts for security. You know, our listeners are now, but you know, we're still a small subset. And yes, Leo, I just, you know, so sad, as you said, what's wrong with people?
Like, well, I feel like there's kind of a breakdown in, maybe this is what old people feel like, in the moral order somehow.
I'm right there with you. Yep.
People don't care anymore, or they just, it's like, I feel like, you know what it is? It's almost an anarchy kind of, a strain of anarchist. People who will do it for the lulls, who do it because they like to see the world burn. And that's what I suspect is going on. It's just like, hey, it wouldn't be funny if we did this. They don't care.
Well, and, you know, there's also this aspect of getting away with it and anonymity. That is, you know, a lot of the mischief that we see is done by people hiding their identity. And this, of course, is a classic mixed blessing of the Internet. There are so many valid, useful, constructive purposes for allowing people to be anonymous, to protect them, for example, from oppressive governments and the like. But that anonymity gets abused as often as not. And the Internet provides a uniquely powerful anonymizing capability. We know it's not perfect. We've talked about, you know, the fact that it wasn't designed to provide that, but, you know, there's a big difference between, you know, throwing a rock through a physical rock through someone's window in the real world, where you can be bodily grabbed by a well-meaning neighbor or by a passing police officer, versus hiding in the basement in some remote country and having a great deal of power to do harm.
I guess that's the question. Is this just, there have always been people like this and just now they have the means? Or
this is definitely an enabling technology.
That's for sure true, but I also feel like there are more people like that than there were before. I think we've raised a generation of kind of asocial, as a result, amoral people who are happy to, who are good with these technologies and happy to use them because they don't have any empathy at all. They just lack that gene, or they've never been trained to because they spent their whole time playing Call of Duty in mom's basement. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I sound old. Forget it. I'm just you know, old person. Get off my internet, you kids.
Yes, well.
Who knows? No one knows. It's one of those questions for the year, the age.
What I love the position we're in, able to watch this happen, to cover the evolving news, to like what you know. We've
this
all been here.
Yeah.
Yes, we've all been here. For example, pre and post Snowden, and so we're riding through. I think a fascinating period where we're going from the concept of a global autonomous network, and it's becoming real, it's becoming vital. I mean, it's in some cases regarded, having access to the internet is considered, you know, not a privilege but a right and a necessity. It's like, I mean, it's that big a deal. I'll never forget when I first proposed GRC taking credit cards to my little group. They looked at me like I was crazy, and I said, "What?" And they said, "Well, no one buys anything on the internet." And I said, "Well, I do." And they said, "Well, you're weird." And
isn't that funny? Boy, that's changed.
Yeah, I used to get Christmas presents from Amazon because I was like, you know,
everybody buys everything on the internet now.
What are their launch customers? And
right.
Yes, and so look at you know. Just in this period of time, how much has changed? I mean, you look around restaurants when everyone's just holding their phones up and tapping into them. It's amazing.
What a world.
I think this is a perfect time for us to be watching this. And, you know, I love the podcast because it is chronicling week by week.
Absolutely.
You know, the nature of these changes.
That's why I've always loved doing this, right? We've got ringside seats at the revolution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so get a load of this one. This is the one I did not see coming. The question this poses is, why did the CIA, assuming that we believe another Vault 7 doc dump from WikiLeaks, why did the CIA create a bogus software upgrade? The answer, apparently, to steal data from the FBI and the NSA.
Oh, God.
I
hope this is not true. Do you think this is true?
Well, okay, so here's what we think. So we sort of assume that we're all on the same side.
Yeah, we know this rivalry, but it's like rivalry of the Marines versus the Army or something.
Precisely, that's what
rivalry.
You want.
Yeah.
And that, for example, there's automatic interagency cooperation and data sharing, despite the fact that they're different organizations. But we've also observed the tendency of agencies to protect their own interests, sometimes at the expense of the larger picture and the greater good, doubtless justifying their actions by telling themselves that this is what they need to do. So if we are to believe the recently leaked so-called Express Lane documents as part of WikiLeaks' most recent and ongoing Vault 7 document dump, it appears that the CIA embedded its own Trojan into an interagency biometrics collection system installed at so-called liaison services and intelligence gathering partners, including the NSA, the Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI. Again, if these documents are to be believed, the CIA didn't trust its security service partners to fully share biometric information with it. So it created a bogus software upgrade to steal the data. This data-stealing Trojan was created as part of a CIA project called ExpressLane, a piece of software installed by the CIA Office of Technical Services, the OTS, under the guise of upgrading the previously installed CIA-provided biometric collection system. The CIA installed the biometric system at partner offices around the world and expected them to voluntarily share biometric data with the CIA. But in case they didn't, it also installed ExpressLane to, quote, verify that this data is also being shared with the agency with a capital A. It also had a feature to cut off the liaison services access to the system if it didn't provide the CIA with access. The documents note that, quote, the systems are provided to liaison with the expectation for sharing of the biometric takes collected on the systems. Some of these biometric systems have already been given to the liaison services. The OTS plans to revisit these sites with the cover of upgrading the biometric software to perform a collection against the biometrics acquisitions, so that OTS agents could install the Trojan in the presence of partner agents. ExpressLane included a splash screen with a progress bar made to look like an authentic Windows install. OTS agents would install the software with a USB stick and could set the installation time of the update as well as a kill date before visiting the target. Once installed, the Trojan collects relevant files and stores them in a secret partition on a specially watermarked thumb drive that the OTS agent inserts during a subsequent maintenance cycle. The biometric system itself was provided by U.S. identity management firm Crossmatch. It specifically didn't want the update to reference Crossmatch's software. So I suppose that our lesson here is the spooks will be spooks. And while we are all still on the same side, the fact that we have agency divisions inherently creates some degree of interagency rivalry and tension. And so
on the other hand, I don't fully trust Julian Assange and stuff from WikiLeaks.
I know. Either. And this is the...
We know that Julian is also very interested in sowing discord among the agencies, and mm-hmm. what better way to do that than this?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is the great danger with anything coming from WikiLeaks, and you know, all security people appreciate this. You know, back when all of the Hillary email controversy was up in the air and stirring, the problem was that it would be easy for a nefarious actor to alter, you know, legitimate email, or to slip in particularly damaging email among a bunch of otherwise, you know, boring stuff about her daughter's wedding and so forth, and you know, be able to ride on the credibility of the rest of the known good stuff. So yes, I'm glad you said that, Leo, because we do need. That's why I made a point of saying, if we are to believe this, then, you know, this is what it's saying. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. So, you know, we don't know. Okay, one more before our next break. There's a company we've discussed in the past, Zerodium, which is kind of a fun name. Zero, as in 0 day. Zerodium. Offering now, get this, $500,000 for secure messaging app 0 day vulnerabilities, which are exploitable. The discovery and private reporting, and this is coverage from ThreatPost, the discovery and private reporting of exploitable 0 day flaws in mainstream secure messaging apps now brings with it a payment of $500,000. Last week, Zerodium, who we discussed before, a vendor operating in the nebulous exploit acquisition market, updated their pricing structure to put a premium on 0 day vulnerabilities in secure messaging applications. Both remote code execution and local privilege elevation 0 days in messaging apps, including WhatsApp, Signal, Facebook Messenger, iMessage, Telegram, and a few others, can fetch as much as $500,000 from the company's new program. As we've covered here before, Zerodium purchases 0 days, then makes them available in a feed of exploits and defensive capabilities to its paying subscription customers. And of course, those attacks and vulnerabilities are never shared with the affected vendor, since they would then be promptly patched and made valueless. So in this dark ecosystem, it is in the interests of everyone within the supply chain, in quotes, the discoverer who wants top dollar for their discovery, Zerodium, who is in this for profit, and the exploit purchasers who want to use the exploits obtained from their subscription as long as possible until they become patched. So it's in everyone's best interest to closely guard and protect the secrecy of the vulnerabilities they are leveraging. Thus, this chain survives. Zerodium's official policy is to sell only to democratic and non-sanctioned governments. But one does wonder how tightly that policy is maintained when cash is dangled, since profit is the underlying motivation here. So they could well just be saying that, you know, for face saving. I mean, again, they're buying exploits and selling them and not reporting them. Their pricing changes were primarily aimed at the mobile platforms. And it's interesting, too, that that's the premium dollar now, is mobile messaging. This suggests that's where the action is. The company is also offering $500,000 payouts for remote code execution and local privilege escalation bugs in default mobile email applications, $150,000 for baseband, like we were discussing recently, the Qualcomm firmware problem, for baseband and media file or document remote code execution and local privilege escalation attacks, $100,000 for sandbox escapes, code signing bypasses, kernel local privilege escalation, Wi-Fi remote code execution, and also SS7 attacks, which we know is the signaling system 7 for the whole cellular network. Zerodium's founder, Bekrar, told ThreatPost that government customers are in need of advanced capabilities and zero-day exploits that allow them to track criminals using these secure mobile apps. And, of course, governments have deep pockets, have the deep pockets required to foot the hefty exploit subscription cost that Zerodium must be levying in order to offer such substantial payouts. That is, they're paying $500,000 for an exploit that doesn't have a super long lifetime, as far as we know. Again, we don't know, but, you know, so they've got to have multiple governments on the back end willing to pay serious money. And who knows, like, what granularity? Like, do they have one contract with the U.S. government that then shares it among our multiple intelligence services? Or is it a per-service agreement? Who knows? Bekrar said, quote, "The high value of zero-day exploits for such apps comes from both a high demand by customers," I choke on that word, "by customers, and a small attack surface in these apps, which make, meaning they're secure and there's not much to go after. It's not like an OS where it's way, you know, like a desktop OS, which makes the discovery and exploitation of critical bugs very challenging for security researchers." In other words, because Google and Apple are really doing, like, they're putting a lot of focus and concentration on security, the consequence is greater security over time. It keeps getting better. So that attack surface gets smaller and smaller, and consequently, it's harder to find problems. But when they are, they're worth more money. So, in other words, they're both rare and valuable. Zerodium also announced that it would offer $300,000 for Windows 10 remote code execution 0 days, specifically remote exploits targeting default Windows services such as, wouldn't you like these, SMB and RDP. That's, of course, the server message blocks that WannaCry exploited to such powerful ends. And RDP is the remote desktop protocol, you know, the remote console services. Also, Web 0 days they're paying for, specifically Apache on Linux and Microsoft IIS remote code execution attacks, are now fetching $150,000, while Microsoft Office remote code execution is worth $100,000, Mozilla Thunderbird remote code execution, and VMware ESX guest-to-host escapes, which are, of course, in the case of VMware, sandbox escapes from the VM, both pull $80,000. ThreatPost notes that Zerodium also doubled, or nearly doubled, payouts for Chrome, PHP, and OpenSSL attacks, while Tor remote code execution on Linux and Windows climbed from 30,000 to 100,000 and 80,000 respectively. Nearly a year ago, Zerodium tripled the bounty it offers for an Apple iOS 10 remote jailbreak to 1.5 million, after previously offering 1 million for iOS 9 0 days. So what we're seeing here is the emergence and continuing evolution of a predictable for-profit ecosystem created by the tension which currently exists between uncrackable crypto and multiple governments' perceived need to monitor whatever they choose of their own and others' citizens' activities. I feel this is not a stable state of affairs. One way or the other, this is a transient created by the post-Snowden and comparatively sudden rush to encrypt after the world learned exactly how much monitoring was actually going on. It's going to be fascinating, as we were saying before, to watch how this fundamental tension resolves itself in our near future, because one way or the other, I think it's going to have to be resolved. In the meantime, you know, this happens. And boy, apparently the market is strong.
The market is strong. Well, and this is what happens, you know, then you don't get the companies don't get the information.
Right.
You know, the bad guys get it.
Right.
Steve, now what?
Now what? Ah, yeah. So, okay, we have a deprecated, insecure Apple authorization API that can be abused to run code with root privileges. This is some more coverage from Kaspersky's Threat Post. And paraphrasing from their coverage, they write, a deprecated Apple authorization API invoked by third-party installers is still developers' preferred choice for updating apps and services on macOS, which has a problem due to a massive security issue that could be abused by local attackers to elevate privileges to root with a little unwitting help from the user. The situation is known and was raised again last month during DEF CON by noted Mac security researcher Patrick Wardle, who's the chief security researcher at CINAC, who happens to be down here in Southern California, not far from me. Due to the ongoing use of the API, it's a function called Authorize Execute with Privileges that installers for many popular applications, including Slack, Google Chrome, Google's owned Dropcam, VMware Fusion, numerous security software updaters, and open source update library Sparkle, all use this deprecated API during installation and updates. At DEF CON, CINAC's Patrick Wardle explained that the API causes the system to display the familiar authentication dialog box. So, I mean, this is part of the OS, which is handled by a separate daemon running in the OS, meaning that the user doesn't have to entrust the application installer with their password. So that's so you're giving your password to this other piece of the operating system, which then works on behalf of the installer in this area, so that you're not trusting the installer, which is, you know, that part is good design. The operating system passes that trust to the daemon, and any functionality needing admin or root privileges upon installation may then proceed without the installer having it. However, this authorization execute with privileges does not validate what is about to be executed on the machine to verify that it was not maliciously modified. Therefore, an attacker that is already present on the computer and has some code running can wait patiently for one of these third-party installers to call upon this insecure authorization API and piggyback off the user's credentials as they are entered into the dialog. So let me be clear that this malicious software also cannot access the credentials themselves, but, as I'll explain in a second, due to the fundamentally insecure design of this, something that's co-resident in your system can use this window of opportunity thanks to the fact that this API does not verify what it's being asked to do the malware's bidding as well. Okay, so Wardle said, normally what happens is these applications ask the operating system to execute something as root, and what they ask to execute is writable by everyone, like something that's in a temp directory or the downloaded application bundle. And, of course, it has to be writable by everyone because they needed to be able to write it. So there's unprivileged access to the thing that the installer wants the OS to then trust. But this means that any running and patient local code, a malware or a local attacker who already has some access to the device, can alter what's about to be executed with root privileges, because by definition and necessity, non-privileged processes have access to what's about to be executed. Since the OS does not verify what the application requested to be to have executed, I'm sorry, that it to have executed wasn't modified, when the user puts in their credentials and clicks install, the system will execute whatever was requested, even if that has been maliciously modified. Wardle said the situation extends to Apple's own installer as well, which suffers from a separate but related issue. He explained that as a user double clicks on a package file, the .pkg, Apple's installer app executes and looks for plugins in the file and copies them to temp, loading those libraries into the process context of the installer application, which is signed by Apple and trusted by the OS. But note that the libraries themselves aren't either signed or trusted, yet they're still stuck into this trusted application space, giving it a lot of power. Wardle said that a local attacker can win a race condition and modify those packages before they're installed on the local system. The malicious and unsigned dynamic libraries, since they're not verified by the installer app, will be blindly loaded, Wardle said. Those malicious dylibs can create their own easily forged authentication pop-up that will be trusted by the OS. The user will then enter their credentials, unwittingly giving malicious code permission to run as root on the machine. Now, here's the sad thing. Apple understood the problem and consequently deprecated this authorization execute with privileges API 4 years ago, back in 2013, and now recommends that developers use a different solution for the same problem called SM Job Bless. SM Job Bless works by copying whatever is being asked to install into a higher privileged directory, and once it's in that secure directory, SM Job Bless cryptographically validates that it has not been tampered with and only then asks the user to authenticate. In other words, they really did solve the problem. So somewhere in 2013, this came to their attention and they said, the way we've been doing this, not so good. So they fixed it, right? Okay, so what's the problem? Using the much more secure SM Job Bless comes at a cost, literally, because developers choosing to use SM Job Bless must obtain an Apple developer certificate to perform the required cryptographic signing. Synax Wardle, who is clearly no slouch, said, quote, and I like this, the problem is that there is a secure solution, meaning SM Job Bless, but it costs money. And, he wrote, it's incredibly complicated. It took me, he wrote, several hours to get it working. Whereas the deprecated and insecure API is literally like three lines of code. He said it's really easy, and that's why everybody does it. Still. Wardle said he privately disclosed to Apple that its installer was loading unsigned libraries, but Apple did not respond. He also reported the API issue to Google with regard to Chrome, and Google responded that it was aware and that, quote, no good replacement exists, including, in their opinion, SM Job Bless. Wardle concluded saying, looking at the secure replacement, it's such a pain to get it working. There's a massive trade-off. In an ideal world, everyone would use the secure replacement, or Apple would provide a secure replacement that would be easier to use. When you have the Chromium guys saying this isn't a valid replacement, they generally know, he says, what they're talking about. So this is admittedly a difficult problem to solve. We know there is no replacement for credentialing developers. It's just like credentialing web servers, which we all do. That's what TLS and HTTPS is for. If we don't do that with web servers, there's no way we can trust their assertions. And this is an example of why Let's Encrypt is an improvement, but not a replacement for full credentialing. As we know, Let's Encrypt promises nothing more than the reuse of the existing HTTPS TLS system for transiting traffic within encryption privacy. But this is and has been massively abused by malicious actors, which is why Let's Encrypt hasn't and doesn't threaten the established certificate authority industry, who continue to provide a service that cannot be automated, because if it could, it would be abused. Similarly, Apple cannot blindly offer free developer certificates to all comers, otherwise all would come. Some would abuse, and no assurance of enhanced security would result. And just as traditional certificate authorities need reasonable payment for the non-automatable and necessary scrutiny they provide, so too does Apple. But that said, it does seem as though Wardle's point about the comment from the Chromium developers is a very good one. Some money needs to be paid, but then the rest should be easy. And certainly Apple is clever enough to make it so, if they gave it the priority that I hope the light that has been shined on it now at DEF CON, thanks to the work of the Synac guys, may light a fire under them in order to make it happen. It feels as though their first pass at this, it's their second pass, was not sufficiently well thought through. They may have been in a hurry to fix that the problem that was discovered. What they came up with was something that, because it's so burdensome, nobody bothers using it, even though it exists. So let's hope they get that fixed and reduce it to a line or two of code, and then a potential vulnerability that we're all living with now. I mean, this isn't patchable. This is not something Apple can fix. They need to fix the underlying API and ultimately deprecate. I'm going to go beyond deprecate. They need to remove this long, insecure, but still available and preferred API. And, of course, Apple gets heat for this. A lot of developers complain that this is one of the problems with Apple, is that they're rolling forward and they're killing off old stuff that's breaking existing code. That's one of the things that Microsoft has not chosen to do over time. As a consequence, they've been dragging all this legacy stuff behind forever, but at least old stuff still works. Apple has decided to take a different approach. And here's an example of where, well, at some point, they're going to have to start warning people, this is going away, and we mean it. But before they do that, they need to come up with a sufficiently useful replacement. But again, this exists today, and now a bright light has been shined on it. And so, yikes. Maybe there can be some sort of a compromise. I don't know. Maybe they can, strengthen the existing API that everyone's using after failing to get everybody to switch over to the new one. Go back and say, well, okay, we gotta do something about this. But the problem is unsigned code. If you don't require signed code, then and that thus make the developers who signed it responsible for their own code's action, then you're never going to have a secure ecosystem. There isn't a way. So, again, it ought to be get a certificate to sign your work, and it ought to be a reasonable price, but then easy to use. All of my code is signed with an AuthentiCode certificate from DigiCert, of course, and it's easy for me to do. When I'm developing code, for example, you know, Squirrel, every release I've offered of Squirrel has been signed. So I'm working myself. When I have something that I want to push out to the gang to test, I just type sign it, and it does. I mean, it's so not a big problem if it's designed right. Okay. We have spoken many times about the, I guess my first instinct is to call it a mixed blessing, but I'm not sure it's so mixed. It's an evil necessity. How's that? The Intel Management Engine, the IME, this separate processor, which we know is running in the Southbridge chip with its own firmware, which has to be there. That is, our motherboards have become so ridiculously complex now that the processor needs a processor. And that's what we've got. We've got a processor. We've got something that fires up when the plug is plugged in, not even when you turn it on. The machine isn't on. The fans are not spinning. The main processor is not on, but the motherboard's processor is lit up and thinking about something. It's easy not to appreciate. Leo, you and I will, and all the old timers among us will. Notice that all of the interrupt jumpers have gone away.
Thank God.
Yes. You know, the COM ports. Oh, my God, I know. I ran out of COM ports, and I can't get any more. Or I got 4 COM ports, but only 2 IRQs, and my COM software is confused because I'm trying to share one IRQ on 2 ports, and I have to re-jumper and re-jigger and blah, blah, blah. You know, all of that. And then there was the memory jumpers. We had to be flipping little dip switches in back and forth in order to move segments of memory around. Those were the good old days.
Are you saying the management engine replaces that? Is that how
yes.
they did it?
Oh, yes, it just all disappeared. Just like, okay, we'll just, you know, people shouldn't have to worry about this. Code should do this. And so, yeah, so it sets all this up. It enumerates the bus. It goes out and scans around. It finds boot ROMs in the different PCI slots, and it figures out what order they should be executed in based on automatic dependency interdependency resolution. I mean, you know, we plugged the plug in, but that thing is busy. And, you know, and it also runs the clocks. It's the reason, for example, BIOSes are like amazing. You look at this thing, it's like, wait a minute. You know, I could just type some numbers and change the frequency of everything. I can change weight states on DRAM and, you know, everything. It's all soft now, thanks to this stuff. So the point is, you really need it after you plug your motherboard in. But the concern has been, you really don't need it afterwards. Yet it hangs around, and our listeners will remember that I chased for a week or two a bizarre problem I had when I added another server to my network about a year ago now. Something was causing an ARP collision because two different things were, I never really even did figure out what the problem was. What I ended up doing was finally thinking, okay, I give up. I don't know what is happening. So I just moved the network interface from the primary NIC to the secondary NIC, and all was well again. The problem just went away. And then it was because I realized that primary NIC was the Intel Management Engine interface, and it was busy messing with my network. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was nothing I could configure. It was all magical and transparent, and in this case, wrong. So we've talked in the past about the concern people have had about the security of this, the fundamental security, because Intel won't tell us what's in there. It's all proprietary and magic and closed, and they've gone to some measures to keep it that way. And as we know, there have been exploits. There have been defects found. We talked about one a few months back. So the guys over at Positive Technologies have discovered that it is, in fact, possible to shut down the vast majority of Intel's worrisome IME motherboard integrated subsystem. The story is the same one we often tell here. Some things can be protected, others cannot. The microcode firmware in Intel's pre-boot environment must be decompressed when it is pulled from storage. And that decompressor code cannot itself be compressed because it's got to do the decompressing. Therefore, if the decompressor could be located and reverse engineered, then the security, then the secretly compressed pre-boot system firmware can be obtained in decompressed form. It turns out the Intel firmware is compressed using something we haven't discussed for a decade, but we did once, the variable length Huffman coding system, which, as it happens, every version of Spinrite has employed for the past 30 years to compress its own highly compressible user interface data. So I built my own Huffman compressor for Spinrite 1.0 because I know that a user interface is highly compressible, and that's just who I am. I want to compress things when I can. Huffman coding is an incredibly elegant and efficient scheme. It does not provide high levels of compression. So it shouldn't be confused with state-of-the-art, you know, block sort compression and Zlib and things, which are far more sophisticated but far more complex to implement. The Huffman coding my algorithm is just like 20 lines of assembly language. So, you know, it's tiny, which is why it makes so much sense to use it. What it does is it takes an alphabet of compressible things, like, for example, machine language bytes, or in my case, user interface text and tokens, and it performs a frequency analysis. It turns it from you could think of it sort of as in time domain to frequency domain. That is, it determines how many of each different token occur. And if they're absolutely uniform, then it's not possible to compress it, to compress it at all. Because this scheme relies on the fact that text and, to a big degree, machine instructions are highly non-uniform. As we know, T and E occur with great frequency in English. And so Q occurs with much lower frequency. So what the Huffman system does, magically, it's so cool, is it automatically assigns the optimal length number of bits to which are shorter for the tokens that occur most often and longer for the tokens that occur least often. So it converts from a fixed length encoding, where, for example, all bytes are 8 bits, to a variable length encoding, where those 8-bit bytes which occur most often end up being represented by just a few bits, and the right number of few bits based on the inter-token competition that automatically exists. Anyway, so that's what Intel did for the same reasons I did. They chose Huffman because it made sense just to squeeze their firmware down. But in the process, it also encoded it. It turned it into gibberish. Now, it's not super strong encoding. You know, a cryptographer would just cut through that in a moment. But what these guys did was they managed to find the Huffman coding table, because what you do when you compress with Huffman, you end up creating this translation table that has to go along with the compressed result, because that's the key used for decompressing what was compressed with it. Unlike, for example, the Lempel-Ziv-based compressors, where their elegance is that you don't need to ever send the dictionary, as it's called, along with it, because it dynamically builds the dictionary on the fly. In this case, because this is such a simple technology, you do have to package the dictionary along with the decompressor. These guys found the dictionary, understood what it was, and then took the Huffman compressed and encoded firmware for this, the microcode, and decompressed it. And then they began looking around. So the page that I've linked to in the show notes, if anyone's interested, provides a painfully deep and very comprehensive dive into the weeds of what they did and what they found. But the short version is they discovered something known as the High Assurance Platform, or HAP for short, and a bit flag for enabling it, whatever it is. They were unfamiliar with the term, but as they wrote, a bit of Googling quickly revealed the truth. The second search result said that the name belongs to a trusted platform program linked to the U.S. National Security Agency, our NSA. Not apparently for any nefarious reason, which I'll explain. After additional research and lots of experimentation, they determined that the setting of this bit flag caused the Intel management engine to be shut down once it had performed all of the necessary work of powering up, configuring, and starting the system, and giving control to the platform's bootable operating system. After that, bye-bye. In other words, the NSA is no more happy than we are to have this potentially buggy, undocumented, secret, and exploit-prone hidden subsystem always running in the background on our motherboards, while it has full access to everything in the system. The NSA, however, has a bit more negotiating leverage than we do, so they were able to get Intel to acquiesce and provide them with this undocumented and well-protected option for completely shutting down the IME immediately upon the completion of its power-up work. Wanting to be absolutely certain of their findings, the Positive Technology guys reached out to Intel for comment and received the following reply. Intel, quote, "In response to requests from customers with specialized requirements, we sometimes explore the modification or disabling of certain features. In this case, the modifications were made at the request of equipment manufacturers in support of their customers' evaluation of the U.S. government's High Assurance Platform program. These modifications," Intel writes, "underwent a limited validation cycle and are not an officially supported configuration." Except they are. But yes, we understand what Intel is saying. In other words, yes, you found it, but we take no responsibility for its use. And after all, we did do everything we could to hide it from everyone to prevent its discovery. But it's there. I don't know if what will surface will be a tool that lets us do that. I wouldn't be surprised. Positive Technologies, current posting is detailed. And they wrote at the beginning that that posting is only the first of several. They're apparently going to tear this thing down to its constituent bits. And it may well be that I don't know if it will ever be user accessible without hardware. There's something called the SPI, which is the serial programming interface. And Leo, you're familiar with it. You actually use it because
I do.
That's how I've updated my firmware, my various gadgets over the years.
Okay.
That's the programming interface. Very common. It's a standard, but it is hardware.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. Okay, I know. I use it for that little whatever that is, the match shipper, whatever. Yeah, the EEPROM.
Exactly. So
Steve and I have a secret thing, a little bit of hardware, and every once in a while he'll send me. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
So I have a little Linux command line utility that does it, but there's
but it does require an SPI programmer, not something that you can do by setting a jumper on the motherboard of our PCs or so forth. So anyway, interesting that in fact, you know, all this grief is that we've been severing and the angst, and here all along there is a program that says, you know, we don't want that running, for no good reason after you've got everything up and going. So turn it off. And now,
there'll be an open source tool that takes advantage of this.
I wouldn't be surprised. I think we're going to see something surface. Yeah. So, anyway, nice piece of work from the Positive Technology guys. So I wanted to keep this on people's radar because this is important. So this is not news per se, except it's another "this actually happened" event. John Biggs, who is a writer, consultant, programmer, and the former East Coast editor and current contributing writer for TechCrunch, wrote, and I lightly edited, at about 9 p.m. on Tuesday, August 22nd, so a week ago today, a hacker deauthorized my phone's SIM card, replaced it with his, presumably by calling T-Mobile. This, of course, shut off network services to my phone and moments later allowed the hacker to change most of my Gmail passwords, my Facebook password, and to impersonate me in texts sent under my identity. I know. All of the two-factor notifications went, by default, to my phone number, so I received none of them. And in about 2 minutes, I was locked out of my digital life. He wrote, I noticed all of this at about an hour later, around 10 p.m., when I assessed the damage and called T-Mobile. By 10:30, I had restored my phone's SIM and began the process of changing all of my passwords, hardening my two-factor accounts and my T-Mobile account, hopefully ensuring that this would not happen again. But he wrote, sadly, I worry it will. He said, my hacker was thorough. In the course of a few minutes, he or she did a quick search of my Facebook Messenger messages and assessed that I was originally from Ohio and that my dad was sick. He or she used this information to approach people I knew in the cryptocurrency space with a story that was arguably ludicrous. Quote, the hospital would pull the plug on my father if they didn't get payment of a bill, and that I, in my anguish, needed to borrow and sell 10 bitcoins immediately and would pay the friend back 15 the next morning. Luckily, he writes, my friends weren't idiots and immediately texted me and my wife. The hacker's IP, 173.239.232.29, which points to Logic Web of Plano, Texas, along with a breadcrumb noting a login from Florida, suggests that the hackers were from the United States. They clearly had the modus operandi down because they also hacked two other friends of mine in the space of a week. This all came about, I believe, after another friend in the cryptocurrency space was hacked last week. That hack, so that would be 2 weeks ago, that hack bore all the same hallmarks as this one, except the SIM hijacking. First, the attacker grabbed access to my friend's Facebook Messenger and contacted everyone on his list that was interested in cryptocurrency, including me. In the ensuing melee, the hacker asked me to send 10 Bitcoin and that he would send me 11 back in the morning. Confused, I told them that I had some Bitcoin, but not that much. I then realized the ruse and asked, I love this, did you talk to Wallace Shawn yet? He can help. I think he's having dinner with Andre right now. Now, of course, for those who don't recognize the references, Wallace Michael Shawn is a well-known actor and comedian who starred in My Dinner with Andre. Anyway, the hacker claimed that Wallace wasn't available. I knew I'd been had. This interaction led to my own subsequent hacking. Once it was clear that I had some Bitcoin somewhere, because that he had admitted in the interchange, the hacker decided I was their next target. He says, ultimately, I got away lucky. Nothing major was stolen as of today, and I took control of my accounts back fairly quickly. I had, he writes, some two-factor setup because my phone was compromised. I had some two-factor setup. But because my phone was compromised, first I lost access to most of it. I've since activated authentication apps, and this, of course, is our takeaway lesson here, for all of my accounts. The biggest question is how the hackers took control of my SIM card in the first place. This is the most troubling, and T-Mobile is, quote, looking into what happened.
Uh-huh. They have recordings of it, and what they'll find is what always happens. A customer service rep wants to serve the customer. They have very nice, very friendly customer service reps who work hard to make you happy.
Yeah,
they believe it's you, even if it's not.
Even if you don't provide sufficient evidence. Oh, yeah. I forgot my mother's maiden name. I used to know it, but it's been so long.
I did that recently, and all they required was the last four of my social.
Wow.
And that isn't that hard to find. I mean, you know, and it's not a really good way of validating, frankly.
Well, and of course, we know that in the U.S., the Social Security number has long been used as an identifier when it's specifically supposed to be excluded from that purpose. But too many people ask for it, and you don't often have a choice not to give it. So our takeaway is this. While it may be unlikely for everyone, targeted attacks can be quite powerful and successful. The new hacking method is to arrange to take over the communications channel, whatever it is, used for account verification and or second factor authentication. This is why time-based one-time passwords, not communications-based one-time passwords, are the only safe choice to make when a choice can be made. And this is exactly what he did when he said, I switched to authentication apps, meaning those apps which automatically give you a changing six-digit code. Then nothing, it's not communications-based after the initial setup, which is over a secure channel, typically a QR code presented to a web page. You snap it with your phone, or in my case, you print it so that you're able to take it offline and then populate other apps in the future. And we'll be discussing that actually a variation on that here in a second. So the problem, of course, is that not all services offer this. And we can hope that as more such instances of this exploitation do surface, more providers will begin offering time-based one-time password or so-called TOTP authentication options. So I appreciate him sharing this and you know, helping to keep this awareness, because it's sad, but the reality is, as you just verified, Leo, that there just isn't enough protecting the ownership of our cell phone accounts, and if sending anything either to email that can then be intercepted by the mail on the phone, or by a text sent to the then registered number of the phone, then that can be a problem. And speaking of time-based one-time passwords, we have Authenticator Plus, which was brought to my attention just by reading feedback from our listeners. It's at www.authenticatorplus.com, and it looks very nice. Everyone knows that my preference is to print, maintain, and manage the QR codes for my one-time password authentications in order to manually curate and install them into new devices. But I get it that some people may choose the convenience of networked linkage and secure cloud backup, which this offers. So in their feature overview, they said secure 256-bit AES encryption and PIN lock for additional security, along with hardware-backed encryption where available, which protects your account even in rooted devices. Syncing across devices. Apps are available for Android, tablets, Android phones and tablets, iPhone, iPad, Android Wear, and Apple Watch. So broadly cross-platform over in the mobile space. Group accounts under organization, group accounts and categories, and the ability to reorder frequently used accounts to the top, change the themes and displays account logo, and account logos for easier lookup. And actually, I really like that feature. It just shows you the icons. So like for Facebook and Google and LastPass and so forth, I just have text now under my Google Authenticator. I'm going to take a look at this. If it's possible to turn off the cloud backup, I would turn it off because I'd rather continue to manage my things offline on paper. But this is otherwise looks like a nice piece of work. On iOS, it's free with in-app purchases, and I haven't looked any further than that. And so I don't know what, and that, which makes me a little uncomfortable. Like, is it going to limit me to 5 sites unless I buy it? I mean, I'd just rather buy it. If I'm going to use it, it's going to be a few bucks. Fine, I'll buy it. So you know, I would want to I want to trust this person, but as we know, that has to be earned. Their FAQ says all the right things about their intentions and policies. So, you know, in fact, it's going to cut all the jargon and so forth. So, again, I can't recommend it because it doesn't have any reputation that, as far as, you know, us having some reason to really believe it's right, but I don't have any reason to believe it's not. And the site looks nice and polished, and you know the FAQ, as I said, is saying everything right. So anyway, it's there. I wanted to point to it.
It's the same as Authy, which I recommended as well, which does very much the same thing, and it's free. Highly recommend Authy. Yeah.
Good, and I agree. And Authy provides the various inter-device sync and cloud sync also?
Yeah.
Good. CrashPlan has shut down or announced that it is shutting down its home offering. They will stop accepting subscription renewals for the consumer version. They're just going to go focus on enterprise. And 9to5 Mac had some coverage, writing, Code 42, the company behind CrashPlan, has officially announced that as of today, they're pulling out of the consumer market. CrashPlan for home users will have to begin migrating away from the service as it will no longer be available starting in October of 2018. So that's responsible. They're giving people, you know, more than a year. In a message posted on CrashPlan's website, the company wrote, effective August 22nd, 2017, so that's last week, last Tuesday, Code 42 will no longer offer new or renew CrashPlan for Home subscriptions, and we will begin to sunset the product over several months. CrashPlan for Home will no longer be available for use starting October 23rd, 2018. So that means that they will honor a subscription created just previous, a one-year subscription just previous to their decision to stop through the end of its life, but, you know, no, you can't get it anymore as of last week. So Code 42 seems to be handling the situation as delicately as possible by giving users ample time, writes 9to5Mac, to prepare for the transition and offering discounts on alternative services, which is very nice. CrashPlan for Home users can transition to the small business plan and receive a 75% discount over the next 12 months. Of course, then the price would jump up to full price after that. If a user wants to completely move away from CrashPlan, the company recommends Carbonite's services. Now, many of our listeners have asked what they should do, so I'll repeat my recent advice from my own research and findings. First of all, I'll just say that Carbonite offers a similar system. That is, an all-in-one, integrated, you know, drop it in and go, you know, as I've mentioned before. That's perfect for Jenny. Jenny has that installed on her laptop. She doesn't know what it is or really why it's there, but it's just, you know, keeping her safe. My advice, I just like the idea of some bifurcation. I get it that there's a place for an integrated all-in-one drop-in, like I gave a perfect example with Jennifer. But I like to have these two things separate. Once upon a time, BoxCryptor was what I was liking because they got the crypto right. I took a deep dive into it, looked at it, verified that it was right. But they have since transitioned from a product to a service. So anyone's use now of BoxCryptor as a service is just as susceptible to them changing their terms of service or canceling it outright, exactly as CrashPlan just has. This is why I don't see the benefit for a more technically sophisticated user of an integrated bundled service. Again, unless you just don't want to worry about it. What I choose is a TNO software solution whose crypto was done right, then choose among any or all of the available cloud storage providers and be free to change your mind or to use any different provider or providers for different purposes at any time. And that's why, as I said recently, CloudBerry Labs has become my current choice. Their crypto's done right. They offer one-time purchase and lifetime use of a product and not a service. And they support every cloud provider any of us has ever heard of, and many we haven't. I looked at their list, and it's like, whoa. I mean, they must have a team that does nothing but, you know, figure out the APIs of providers. And, in fact, it may be that we're now beginning to see some merging of API. So as long as providers support this emerging standard way of accessing their services, well, then you can use one thing everywhere, which is great. But anyway, so, you know, Carbonite, if you want a good alternative turnkey solution, or CloudBerry Labs is what I use personally, what I use at GRC. And Sue is still using JungleDisk just because she always has been, and it still works. So, you know, that, which is more of a turnkey solution also. So my slip of the tongue, I can't believe I did this. And so the first note came from a Daniel. Wow, and Daniel, I'm sorry I can't pronounce your last name. Looks like Shmuelowitz. Anyway, sorry, Daniel. He wrote, "You meant atomicity, not monotonicity, in the section explaining compare and swap." He said, "I hope you don't mind me saying." And I said, "Of course." I actually thanked him for his note and said, "Of course, I don't mind you saying." So, and then I thought, okay, I must have just been something I said once. Whoops. Then Chris Frederick, who has a more easily pronounced last name, said, "You talk quite a bit about monotonic operations and functions in the latest podcast. I wonder, did you mean to say atomic operations?" And so, okay, as I said at the top of the show, I must have just started off saying monotonic, and which is a term I use often when I'm talking about counting, counters that only count upwards, but, you know, incrementing are monotonic. They increment monotonically. And so I apparently started off saying monotonic, and I just let it rip. And kept saying it. Yes, I meant atomic. The reason they're called atomic operations is they are indivisible by an interrupt. That is, you know, if you do a separate compare instruction then a swap instruction, that entire instruction pair is not atomic. It's a molecule, and so composed of two atoms. So you can split them apart with an interrupt, which might occur between them, thus the problem. So these are called atomic operations because they are operations that are not splittable any longer. Anyway, thank you for bringing it up, and for anyone else who was confused, I apologize. Okay, maybe I do need my mustache. Oh, that was pre-mustache. That was when I still had the mustache. So,
No excuse.
Yeah. Meanwhile, another of our listeners, who I hear from time to time, the aspiring lockpicker, said, "I used my auto-it UDF to break apart Steve's Security Now pages to get at the minute and episode number of all shows and do the math. A fun few minutes. Security Now has, as of this moment, 908.05 hours of total content spread across 623 episodes. So, not quite 1,000 hours, 908. A shred over 908 hours of content." Yep. And growing at the rate of about 2 hours a week. And two interesting quick little points about SpinRite. I saw a note from an XOff 00. Boy, I haven't seen XOff for a long time. The XON and XOff are two reserved ASCII non-printable control codes which were used to start and stop the paper tape reader, or I guess maybe sometimes, well, I think it's just, I don't think it was optical. It was back in the teletype days. Something would send an X off if its buffer was filling and it needed to stop the reader from going as it was reading the holes in paper tape. Then the reader would catch up and then start again. And it's a software flow control. That's how it's better known. And so it exists in some terminal applications and so forth. Anyway, he said a coworker just told me he regularly runs SpinRite on USB thumb drives. Your thoughts? And it's interesting. I think it's a great idea. One of the things we know is that thumb drives have become incredibly inexpensive, super cheap. Unfortunately, they're cheap in both senses of the term. They're both inexpensive and they are low quality. No expense beyond the bare minimum has been put into them, and people have problems with them. Running a level 2 scan will not fatigue the thumb drive, but it will help to keep it alive. And the idea is that, you know, the more robust SSDs are highly over-provisioned, sometimes as much as 40% over-provisioning, meaning there's an additional 40% of storage space you don't see. So it's actually, even though they say, you know, it's 64 gigs, that's the 100%. It's actually 140%, for example, in terms of physical storage. And the reason is that gives it resilience and life. And as spots go bad, as they will, then the reserved area gets pulled into use, making that aging and fatiguing transparent over time. SpinRite, as we keep seeing, is great on non-volatile solid-state media, almost perversely as good as it is on spinning media for which it was designed, because the underlying technology is still very similar. So, yes, if you are a heavy thumb drive user, giving a thumb drive, a SpinRite level 2 scan from time to time makes lots of sense. And I imagine doing so regularly will help to keep them from ever dying.
I should mention that our official count is 968 hours. I'm not sure where the other 60 hours come from.
Interesting. I wonder, I don't know whether he...
whether
his data pulled from the metadata of the MP3s,
right,
or if he parsed my pages, because I'm normally rounding down to, I guess, no, I'm rounding, so I don't know.
Yeah.
It could be rounding error or what, but that's a large difference, so...
Patrick Delahanty, the keeper of the stats, says 40 days, 7 hours, 59 minutes, and 18 seconds of content average. Running time, 1 hour, 32 minutes, and 20 seconds.
My goodness.
Yeah.
And that average is going up over time,
yeah,
too.
629 episodes, including special episodes with non-standard numbers. So the episode count is roughly right. But
yeah. Hmm. Interesting. Well, I mentioned a couple weeks ago, I think it was recently, that one of the nice things about SpinRite was that it was so small. You could run it in a 640K VM, and it would be completely happy because it pulls in DOS and it pulls in itself. I mean, it used to run in and can run in a 640K memory environment. The problem is I don't think VMs go that small. You know, the dial, you can't turn the dial down that much.
At least a megabyte, yeah.
Anyway, so I got a tweet from a Flitbee. I have the photo. I wasn't able to grab it off of it. He just sent it in my Twitter stream, but I captured it. Well, but I got a kick out of it. He sent SpinRite scanning two drives in a 128 meg VM. So, and it shows two SpinRite windows side by side with SpinRite running away. And this is what's cool, is that unlike running whole operating systems that require a gig or more each, SpinRite is actually very practical to run in a virtual machine because it requires just hundreds of K. I may think about this maybe for the future. My plan for after version 6 is to, you know, the version 6 series, the idea is to use it as the platform for developing the next generation of hardware interface technology. So all SpinRite 6 users will get the benefit of that immediately. But the goal is to come up to speed with the state of the art hardware support, finally getting rid of the BIOS and all that. And that will then be a proven base upon which SpinRite 7 gets written to, and that's where we lose the textual DOS interface and DOS completely, and I roll up my sleeves and probably do a hybrid of assembly language and Python, because everyone would rather have it sooner rather than later, and it just makes sense at this point to move us off to a higher level environment. One quick closing the loop note from a Pete Blumenthal who listens, and then we'll talk about shattering trust. And I like this. This caught my attention just as we were getting ready to go on air. So I dropped this in at the last minute. He asked about my thoughts on voice print for phone authentication. And then he gave a link to a Fidelity.com something or other, TD Bank something. He says, I see no technical details, but we don't need any. And I have a couple thoughts which I think are useful. First of all, it's clearly a bad idea if the phrase you are asked to repeat for your voice print is unchanging, because anyone could make a recording and play the recording. But if instead you are shown something on the screen which you then must speak, so that every utterance for authentication is unique, then it's interesting. It's not that someone can't impersonate someone else's voice. We know we've heard very good impersonations, and we know that software, unfortunately, is rapidly acquiring that ability, the ability to do exactly that. But what I liked about those two counterexamples, repeating the same thing versus being challenged with a unique statement to utter, is one is like a password where your password is unchanging. You always put the same thing in. So, for example, a keystroke logger can capture it. The second one, the better security, is the challenge response model, where you are challenged in some form with something that has never been offered before and will never be repeated, to solve the replay attack problem, and then you must respond to that unique challenge properly and correctly. So anyway, I just like that as a Pete's question as a jumping off point, because it's interesting to consider that, as, you know, voice print as a biometric. Makes me nervous, especially if it was done wrong, and it could be done wrong if it was the non-challenge and response authentication, if it was just, you know, say your magic phrase, again, because that's trivial to capture and to repeat. So, cool question, though, Peter. Thank you. And, finally, shattering trust. When replacement smartphone components attack is the title of the paper. Very interesting piece of work these guys did. Their abstract explains the concept. They said, phone touchscreens and other similar hardware components, such as orientation sensors, wireless charging controllers, and NFC readers, are often produced by third-party manufacturers and not by the phone vendors themselves. Okay, so in other words, our modern smartphone is a system. You know, it's got a bunch of peripherals which are all in the same package, and, you know, we hold it all in one hand. But in fact, those subcomponents come from somewhere else. The third-party driver source code to support these components is integrated into the vendor's source code. In contrast to pluggable drivers, such as USB or network drivers, the component driver source code implicitly assumes that the component hardware is authentic and trustworthy. As a result of this trust, they write, very few integrity checks are performed on the communications between the component and the device's main processor, which is where we insert what could possibly go wrong. They write, in this paper, we call this implicit trust into question, considering the fact that touchscreens are often shattered and then replaced with aftermarket components of questionable origin. We analyze the operation of a commonly used touchscreen controller. In this case, it was from an Android device. We construct two standalone attacks. based on malicious touchscreen hardware that function as building blocks toward a full attack, a series of touch injection attacks that allow the touchscreen itself to impersonate the user and exfiltrate data, and a buffer overflow attack that lets the attacker execute privileged operations. Combining the two building blocks, we then present and evaluate a series of end-to-end attacks that can severely compromise a stock Android phone using standard firmware. Our results make the case for a hardware-based physical countermeasure. So in other words, there is currently an assumption of trust among the hardware subsystems of Android smartphones. I'm reminded once again of that classic scene, and here's where we talked about the Wrath of Khan from Star Trek, the Wrath of Khan, where Khan was approaching under radio silence, and Kirk had not raised his shields. Spock cited regulations about the need to adopt a defensive posture wherever the intentions of an approaching ship had not been confirmed. Kirk waved Spock off. One of Khan's own minions commented that Kirk was not raising his shields, to which Khan replied, "Of course not. We're all one big happy federation." Whereupon Khan blasted the crap out of the Enterprise.
What?
Oh, yes. So, as we have seen many times, it's all about security boundaries and where those boundaries are placed.
But wait, why didn't Kirk raise his shields?
Because, you know, he thought he knew the captain of the ship that was approaching, and they hadn't been able to establish comms.
Okay.
But he thought, That's odd. And you sort of,
A strange lapse on the part.
That's when the first photon torpedo hit.
Of James Tiberius Kirk. A strange lapse.
Yeah, well, it was funny, too, because I think it was Scotty or somebody else on the bridge chided Spock for, like, telling Kirk what he well knew. And then Kirk afterwards said, "You just go right on quoting regulations."
It was only logical.
Not that I've memorized the
of
the show. As we've seen many times, as I was saying, it's about security boundaries and where they're placed. If a system's security boundaries are all-inclusive, that is, if there are no internal boundaries, then any adversary who manages to slip inside the system's outer boundary will potentially obtain unfettered access to the keys to the kingdom. In their research paper, way later on, and I've got the link to the paper in the show notes if anyone's interested, they say counterfeit components have been in existence ever since the dawn of the industrial age. Their effectiveness as attack vectors is also well known. What then is unique about the particular setting of a smartphone? We argue that our specific attack model is feasible because we assume only a specific component with an extremely limited hardware interface is malicious, while the rest of the phone, both hardware and software, can still be trusted. Furthermore, we assume that the repair technician installing the component themselves are not malicious, and will perform no additional operations other than replacing the original broken component with an unknown to them malicious one. Hundreds of millions of devices satisfying this attack model exist in the wild. One can assume that these limitations make this attack vector weaker than complete hardware replacement. We show it is not. On the contrary, the nature of the smartphone ecosystem makes this attack model both practical and effective. In other words, people are shattering their screens. They are taking them to third-party service organizations. They are having them replaced with aftermarket screens of unknown or non-OEM, not the original equipment manufacturer origin. And the firmware, what these guys did is just by changing the firmware programming, they were able to completely commandeer and take over Android smartphones from the setting of the processor. Ah, oh, you found the scene.
Just like Khan. I love Khan's extended family. There you go. Well, we're all one big happy family, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the authors followed responsible disclosure practices by disclosing the Synaptics device driver vulnerabilities to Google back around the middle of February of this year. The disclosure includes the details necessary for understanding, reproducing, and fixing the issues discovered during their research. Google acknowledged the reported issues and issued a CVE, the Common Vulnerability Index, of 2017-0650 with critical severity. The vulnerabilities discovered in the Atmel device driver, so there was a little Atmel chip in the keyboard, are being compiled into a responsible disclosure report at the time of the submission of the paper. And they conclude saying, the threat of a malicious peripheral existing inside consumer electronics should not be taken lightly. As this paper shows, attacks by malicious peripherals are feasible, scalable, and invisible to most detection techniques. Yeah, nothing would, you could scan the firmware of the phone till the cows came home. I mean, it's up there in the keyboard where you would never think to look. A well-motivated adversary, they write, may be capable of mounting such attacks in a large scale or against specific targets. System designers should consider replacement components to be outside the phone's trust boundary and design their defenses accordingly. So, really interesting. I mean, fully fleshed out proof of concept. Go to a service place, have the screen on your phone replaced, and at the moment, it has the ability to take over the device. Trust boundaries.
And this is, by the way, Apple is, you know, very reluctant to let third-party replace phones. And if they do, remember, yeah, there was a problem. There was actually a bug in Apple's firmware that crashed or bricked the phone if the screen had been replaced.
Remember well, that? And remember, it was the Touch ID.
Because they felt it had been compromised. Exactly.
Right. The people were getting their iOS devices swapped for screens, but since they couldn't reproduce Apple's proprietary fingerprint sensor, they were non-fingerprint sensor Touch ID. Non-Touch ID. And the phone said, what? And, you know, said, no way, I'm not going to, which is good. There's a strong security boundary. It said, third party, no. Now, mixed blessing, of course, because some people say, wait, it's so much cheaper to use the third party than to use, you know, Apple certified service. And unfortunately, sometimes you get what you pay for or even more than you paid for.
Well, part of this is also because Apple doesn't offer any third parties the official
right
parts.
Right.
I mean, that might be another way to solve it. Apple prefer that you go to them.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Don't use third-party parts for security devices.
If an untrusted chip is approaching, always raise your shields.
Yeah, raise your shields, for crying. Especially if some guy not wearing a shirt. Well, I guess he didn't know that yet. That came about later. Come!
He was very macho, Leo.
He was,
you know, genetically engineered. Yep.
Dave Gibson has been genetically engineered to be mustache-free.
I wish.
But don't.
I hate shaving.
I know.
Nice, I know.
It's going to grow. Let's just all grow beards.
No.
Let's just do it. Let's just do it. Just take it out of the equation. Of course, then we would lose our sponsorships. But that's okay. That's okay. Steve is the man in charge at GRC, the Gibson Research Corporation. So if you get a bill for research, it's probably because you bought SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. That's at GRC.com. Everything else is free, though. You won't get a bill for, you know, the Shields Up service the work he's doing on Squirrel or the password, perfect paper passwords and password haystacks, all that stuff is there and browsable at grc.com. So is this show. He's got the audio of the show and full transcripts at grc.com. We have audio and video at our site, twit.tv/sn, twit.tv/sn. And but really the best way to do it is to subscribe. Use your podcatcher, you know, whether it's Overcast or Pocket Casts or, whatever you, iTunes, whatever, Stitcher, Slacker, subscribe to Security Now so you have every episode, all 638 or whatever it is. 600. It says, see, this is where he went wrong. It says 626, but there are actually more episodes than that.
Yeah, and there was like an A, and some we skipped, and there was a little renumbering. I mean, things have been very smooth for the last decade, but we got off to a little bit of a rocky start.
When Neil was running it, it wasn't so good. Now that I have trained professionals.
That would be the case for my enterprise were I going solo. So I got an email from Sue. Don't forget to get the car smogged because it's like, oh, thank goodness for Sue. I mean, because, you know.
Wait, she told you to get your car smogged?
Oh, she runs my life.
Wow.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
That's a very handy person.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sue. And thank you, Steve. We'll be back here next Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC, if you want to tune in and join us. Look forward to that, and I guess that's all there is to be said about this show, except we'll see you next week, Steve.
Thanks, Leo. See you for episode 627 next week. Bye.
Wow. Security.